Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Disney Film Project Podcast. This is the show where we peruse the fine array of Disney films. Everything, Snow White, Tron Legacy, Romeo and Juliet. Okay, we probably aren't going to do that one because, frankly, none of us want to see it. But anything else Disney film, we're going to get to it eventually here on this here show. I am Ryan Kilpatrick, owner, proprietor, blogger at Disney Film Project, located at DisneyFilmProject.com. My co-host, two of the finest film buffs ever known to man, not just Disney film buffs, anywhere, film buffs of all kinds. First, Mr. Todd Perlmutter, blogger at TouringPlans.com and chief technical officer at DisneyDrivenLife.com. Hello, Todd.
Hey, Ryan, how you doing?
I am doing well. Todd, how are you?
I'm hanging in there. They told me the world's ending outside and sky is falling, lightning's falling, and Florida's about to fall off the earth and zoom into space, and that's the end of it all.
Well, at least it'll be a fun ride.
I hope so.
You'll have to blog or tweet about it or something so we can all keep up with your...
I'm taking Disney World with me.
That won't be good. The other co-host of this show, the one and only Miss Brianna Alessio, renowned blogger at The Adventures of Bree at adventuresofbree.blogspot.com, all-around film lover and a swell tiara-wearing princess. How are you, Bree?
I'm doing well, but I believe New York is also going to fall into the ocean with Florida because of the snow.
Just the weight of the snow?
I think the weight of snow, because we're supposed to get even more this week, and it's just too much. It's too much for us to handle.
You have had a lot of snow.
Yeah, it's a little ridiculous.
There is, of course, the most important part of our show, the person recording all of this and shaking her fist in anger anytime we laugh and make more edits for her, Miss Cheryl Perlmutter, the local Disney fan, internet superstar, and talented editor who I think cranks out about 7 of these a day. How are you, Cheryl?
Doing good.
Are you surviving down there?
I don't know. I cranked out another episode today. I'm good.
I know. You're cranking them out like crazy, man. Just if things start getting wonky down there, you know, with the rain and everything, just kind of throw Todd and you can come up this way. We're safe up here in Georgia, so.
Oh, that's good. Disney World. They make it. There's a bubble around there, you know. There's a secret force bubble. Kind of like The Incredibles.
Perfect. All right. And every so often, of course, we invite our friends from around the Disney community to join us and share some of their appreciation for their favorite Disney film. Today, we're thrilled to have Mr. Jeff Chaney with us. Jeff is well known as Neurotic Disney Dad number 109, the heart and soul of the Beta Mouse podcast. Great podcast. And a fabulous guest blogger for WedwayRadio.com and a man who loves to laugh. How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing very well. How are you, Ryan?
I am doing well as well. I have neither rain nor snow, so I'm doing okay.
Well, I am definitely honored to be here. We have lots and lots of snow here in Indiana as well. It's cold, and we're also getting more snow. We've already had more than twice as much as our average, and it's only January. Yeah.
Wow. We had a lot of snow here for like a week, and then we're good.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
What is this snow stuff you all speak of?
It's that stuff you used to have to live with before you abandoned us, Northerners.
Todd, you must leave the podcast now.
Yes, he had to flee. I think I get snow about one day more a year than Todd does. All right, so Jeff, since you are the guest on tonight's show, we are discussing your favorite film. Why don't you tell us which film we're discussing and why it is your favorite?
So this film was groundbreaking in a lot of different ways. One of the earliest feature films to use both animated and live action characters. It harkens to an era when Broadway was still pretty closely associated to what we saw on the big screen. Music, dancing, characters that you can relate to, a good morale. You know, it was practically perfect in almost every way.
And that film would be?
Mary Poppins.
Of course. I don't think you're going to find many people who are going to listen to this show who are not going to agree with you on everything you just said. So this is a fabulous, fabulous movie. We will discuss in depth
Absolutely.
All right, so Mary Poppins was released in August of 1964 with a grand Hollywood premiere. It is based on a series of books by P.L. Travers. This particular film is based on primarily the first book, but there are some pieces from later books that are included. Walt started chasing the rights to do this as early as 1938. P.L. Travers was living in New York as a Brit expatriate trying to escape the Nazi bombing of London, and Walt and Roy tried to woo her for quite some time to see if she would allow him to make this film. However, she did not believe that Walt could make a live-action film. How wrong she was. So for 20 years, Walt pursued the rights to this film. And once he had finally kind of proven himself in live action, then Travers allowed him to get the rights to the film, to the book, rather, to make the film. She and Walt fought constantly over the making of this film. I think the only thing I could relate P.L. Travers to today would be J.K. Rowling and the control she's had over the Harry Potter series. It's very similar. I don't know what you guys, please chime in if you disagree, but
completely agree.
Yeah. She all sorts of things that she wanted from the films that Walt had to fight with her for. She did not want any animated sequences in the film. She didn't want any hint of romance between Bert and Mary in the film. Bert is actually a combination of a few characters, and she wasn't exactly happy about that either. She wanted the songs in the film to reflect the period that the film is set in. The film is set in the turn of the century Edwardian era, which is not what the books were set in. But Travers okayed that change, but she wanted the songs to fit that era, which obviously did not fly with Walt. So they fought a lot about how this film would turn out. And honestly, in the end, Walt got about 90% of what he wanted.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I like her very much.
Well, you know, did you know she was Australian? Not actually from Britain originally.
Oh, really?
I did not know that.
Yeah, in fact, that's why she makes odd references. Well, she has Mary Poppins make odd references to things like kangaroos and stuff like that because of that origin of herself.
Oh.
The character actually started out from her childhood. She was like the oldest of three sisters, and her father left the family. He was actually a banker himself, a bank clerk. It's never really clear what, you know, Mr. Banks' role is at the bank. He just kind of works there, and you get a feeling he's kind of sort of higher up, which implies that he's not a clerk. But that's never made clear. But that's why their name is Banks. He's a banker. That's where that all comes from. Also, she told this story to her sisters on a particularly bad night when her mother was flipping out during a rainstorm and like ran outside, said she was going to kill herself, and the two younger sisters were all freaking out, and she tells this story about a magical white horse on a comet, okay, and later on in life she continued the story in her head until the point where she had a vision that the white horse that flew like a comet ran underground and came up as Mary Poppins, and that's where the character comes from.
Wow.
So, Mary Poppins was apparently once a magical white horse. And that's just the background on the character right there. It's pretty neat.
Not where I thought you were going with that.
No, yeah. Now you're right though, Ryan, about the books. Much of the books did make it in. There's some big stuff that didn't make it in that literally got cut, and it's like, you know, majorly cut, because they even did the whole zoo sequence. They had actually like filmed a lot of and done some music for, and then they just abandoned it all because they didn't like it. And there was also this whole concept of a compass and following the compass to various points around the world, and that whole bit got cut as well.
Yeah, so the way the film got put together is actually kind of similar to the way a lot of Disney musical films are put together. So Nightmare Before Christmas was done this way. Beauty and the Beast was done this way, where the songs were actually written first, and then the story was composed around the songs. And in my opinion, as someone who loves those two films as well as this one, that was a great thing to do, especially with this one and the Sherman Brothers and the music that they came up with for the film. The way that it actually came about, Walt handed them the original book, and said, take a look at this. They came back to him and it highlighted six chapters that they said, you know, this is what we want to base the story around. And he kind of chuckled, pulled out his copy of the book, and he had highlighted the same six chapters. And that's how the Sherman Brothers got the job to compose the film's score, which is brilliant, and so on and so forth.
Cool.
All right, so shall we dive on into the story of this one and some of the great work that was done on it?
Yes.
All right. So this, as we mentioned, that this takes place in the Edwardian era in England. It takes place around 1910. We know that from the song Mr. Banks sings in The Life I Lead, which I was walking around the house quoting last night. Which is because I love that song.
I find this very funny that it's 1910 because King Edward actually dies in 1910. He died in 1910. And this takes place significantly after that. And you would think that they kind of maybe knew that. So it's kind of, to me, it's strange that they would pick that year. And he specifically says in the song, King Edward, you know, King Edward is
King
on the
Edward's
throne.
And it's like,
he wasn't on the throne by the, you know.
That's what I was seeing last night. I was walking around the house. King Edward's on the throne. It's the age of men.
So King Edward died in October of 1910, and the film would be taking place in April of 1910. Okay. And I know fair it's enough. April because there were cherry blossoms.
Wow.
Wow. Look
so,
at that.
Cherry Blossom Lane, and there were over 6,000 handmade cherry blossoms attached to those trees on Cherry Blossom Lane. So it would have been April. Early April.
Wow.
Impressive. 10.
See, that's why we have Jeff Cheney on the show.
Because yeah, I sure. know a bunch of useless trivia, but that's okay.
Have you listened to our show?
Yeah, we're all about
yes,
the useless
yes,
trivia.
Yes, I have.
It's useless trivia. That's what we do. So we've talked about this film is, you know, it's a series of vignettes, really. From the books, but the difference between this and some of the other films that we've looked at, like I'll contrast it to say like Alice in Wonderland, which is also based on a British novel that is a series of vignettes. We talk about in that film that those vignettes are not really strung together very well, whereas in this one there's definitely a heart and a connective tissue to it that just makes it so powerful. And I think that's what makes Mary Poppins such a amazing film, really.
I think the music helps tremendously there.
I mean,
the music is the glue. In fact, I know, you know, really there's only about like five or six scenes in the actual movie, but I kind of, to me, the movie breaks down by the songs because clearly that's a much more defined set of components. And this is, you know, each song has a scene and goes. I think you had something to say about that, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to point out, too, one of the best parts of the music to me is that within each scene, there are parts of the songs or the scene that use themes from other songs. So, you know, you have intertwined, you know, the chim-chimmery melody mixed in with Spoonful of Sugar. So it really helps to also set the tone of a scene, or it kind of harkens to what the character's thinking based on, oh, he's singing part of chim-chimmery, but to the melody of a Spoonful of Sugar.
Right.
That's a different mood that he's in. So. Kind of,
but he's constantly humming the various songs too. Bert is every yep. time you see him, he's humming different sets of the songs throughout the yep. whole thing.
So I think the theme of this film, you know, we can all come at it from a little bit of a different perspective. But I know Jeff and I are both fathers, and this one hits really close to home for me. I mean, when I was younger, it was it really got to me. It was about, you know, hey, you need to stop and smell the roses. But as I've become a father, I know that's kind of changed. I don't know if it's the same for you, Jeff.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, watching it as a father now, I mean, I've watched this film since I was a child, and obviously it's changed its meaning. And coming back to watching it here recently, you know, it really makes you think of what kind of father you are, you know, how much of an active role you're taking in your the raising of your children. And, you know, I think, too, it made me think of you work to live, don't live to work.
Amen, brother.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to comment on the, well, we don't have kids, so I kind of see this, but I kind of see the movie as kind of not, kind of like Alice a little bit. It's a little bit like the Narnia movies, where they're a little bit nonsensical. You know, they just are there enjoying the nanny, enjoying Mary Poppins, enjoying, you know, enjoying stuff and singing along. And I think that is being careless, and I enjoy that part of it. It does makes me like kind of be like the Disney, feeling like a kid again.
I think there's a really good reason for that is these are kids who are in a bad situation. They're reacting badly to the bad situation. And what Mary Poppins is doing is distracting them while trying to heal the situation at the same time. And the distractions work really well because they completely forget the bad things and they do start to focus on the good things.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right on that. I think that's the whole way the film's constructed too, right? It's about these you know, the jolly holidays and those sequences that are so fun and exciting, but then there's always that undercurrent of, you know, Mr. Banks and what's going on with him. You know, he's the character that grows the most throughout the story. But the film opens with a piece that really demonstrates, I think, some of the artistry that went into this film. It's a matte painting by Peter Ellenshaw, who is an amazing artist who created these matte paintings. And what those are is they're a piece of glass that Ellenshaw would paint the scene on. And then they would cut a hole in the glass, place the glass on the camera lens, and all you would see through the hole, they would frame up the set where the actors would perform. So that you would see the live set composed with the matte painting, and it would be a seamless, you know, one shot. For the film, Ellenshaw did 102 matte paintings.
Amazing.
It's almost unheard of. And because of that, they did not have to create any exterior sets for this film. So every shot in the film was shot on the Disney lot inside a soundstage. There was nothing shot outside.
That's interesting. It explains, because I was wondering, at one point you're, and I know I'm jumping ahead a bit, but there's a shot way across, and you see the cathedral dome way off in the distance, and I was wondering why it was so blurry, and now that makes a lot more sense to me, because I really thought the painting was only in the beginning credits. I didn't realize that it was so much more pervasive than that.
No, all the matte shots are actually, like, even when the kids are running away from the bank. So the only physical set pieces in those shots are where their feet are walking for the most part. Everything else is a matte painting, which
incredible.
You know, watching the film yesterday, having learned that, and then watching the film, I couldn't believe it because you can't really tell. It's just an amazing piece of work, I think. Leonard Maltin actually says that this was Peter Ellenshaw's masterpiece as a filmmaker, just as much as it was Walt Disney's or anyone else's. But the opening credits show this nice panoramic scene of the city of London, and then there you see the scene of the cloud where you see the figure of Mary Poppins as part of the matte painting, and then they zoom in to show her on the cloud sitting there, which I don't know this, but I would think she's inserted in that piece because she doesn't show up for the next 20 to 25 minutes into the film. So I would imagine, you know, it made sense for them to put her in the very beginning, say, hey, yeah, this movie is about Mary Poppins from the get-go.
Yeah, I think, too, it was a nod to the beginning of Dumbo, where the baby elephant's falling through the cloud and he's getting snatched back up and falling through and snatched back up. And Mary does that with her carpet bag as well as the umbrella.
Yeah, good call. Good call. So we pan down from the city. And again, it's still a matte painting, which is amazing, but it pans down from the city onto Cherry Tree Lane, where we see Bert, played by the wonderful Dick Van Dyke, who has two claims on this film that he makes to this day. Number one, that it's the best film he's ever made. And number two, it's the worst accent ever put on film.
I don't know if you have heard any interviews with him, but he talks about he was actually taught his accent by an Irish man who could do an English accent.
I did read that. That's funny. But it was an interesting choice that the way that the film opens, of course, we have Dick Van Dyke as Bert, you know, doing his one-man band sequence and kind of previewing a lot of the music from the film and talking to the other characters around. But then once all the other characters leave, he turns to the camera and kind of breaks the fourth wall, which I thought was an interesting choice.
I love how everyone surrounding Bert was kind of jumping away from him, almost in fear of being smacked by one of his wonky instruments.
It's true. Yeah, and it was interesting too, because in the film he gets to use a lot of the skills that he didn't get to use on the Dick Van Dyke Show. You know, he did a lot of physical comedy on that show, but he did not do a lot of dancing or singing, which are things he gets to do in this movie. But Dick Van Dyke, of course, takes us on the little tour of Cherry Tree Lane past Admiral Boom, which is another matte painting, by the way. I don't know if you guys know that, but his entire house is a matte painting. The only part of the house that's actually real is the part where the Admiral and I don't know what his little sidekick's name is.
I have no idea either.
Just First Mate.
First Mate, yes. Admiral Boom had his own song. I don't know if you guys caught that, but they composed a song for Admiral Boom, and it plays when you first see him.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Little thing
to learn. You can go.
It originally had lyrics, but they cut that part out and just used the music.
Yeah, actually, they use one line from it. It's actually said by Bert when he's walking up. He's the line where he goes, "The whole world takes its time from Greenwich, but Greenwich, they say it takes time from Admiral Boom." That line is actually the one remaining lyric from the song.
Cool. It's a great line.
Can I actually make a mention about Admiral Boom?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
So the actor who played him was Reginald Owen. And he portrayed Ebenezer Scrooge in the 1938 version of A Christmas Carol, which is not, it was actually my second favorite. My first favorite is 1951 with Alastair Sim. But anyway, that scene where he lets the cannon loose each time, it reminds me a lot of Arsenic and Old Lace with Cary Grant, when the old lady's brother, who thinks he's Teddy Roosevelt, runs up the stairs screaming, "Charge!" And Cary Grant and the ants have to hold the clock still. That's what it reminds me of in Mary Poppins, when everyone has to hold everything still.
Interesting. Okay.
Observation.
good observation at that.
Thank you.
So we end up, of course, Bert takes us over to Cherry Tree Lane, which that's why I thought it was so interesting that he breaks the fourth wall, because when we get to the Banks household, we all of a sudden exit that and he's not talking to the camera anymore. So I don't know. It works, but it's just an interesting choice, I thought. So we go, and of course, Katie Nana is leaving the household because the children have run off. And then we get introduced to Mrs. Banks, who comes in to the song Sister Suffragette. Which I have to say is like one of my favorite things about the entire film. And when I went to see the musical, I was very mad that it was not in it.
Oh, interesting. It's not in it.
It is not in the Broadway musical. So originally they were going to introduce Mary Poppins with a song called Practically Perfect. And they chose not to do that, and they used Sister Suffragette and do Sister Suffragette instead with the fabulous Glynis Johns as Mrs. Banks, and she comes in and sings her song about you know, freeing the women and getting the vote for women and all these sorts of things.
Which I find, like, absolutely hilarious, because she's talking about tossing the shackles, and she's, like, the epitome of not doing that. She doesn't have a job. She pretty much totally relies on Mr. Banks, and she's the only female in the movie who doesn't have a job.
I could not agree less.
Oh,
really?
I think Mrs. Banks is the puppet master behind this entire film.
It's actually Mrs. Lark.
No, because I am dead serious. I'm not making a joke here, because if you think about it, right, she comes in and she's doing her rallies and all this sort of thing. And, you know, she comes in and Mr. Banks comes in and sings his song, The Life I Lead, about, you know, what's going on in his life. And that's, you know, King Edward's on the throne. It's the age of men. He is clueless. That I will say. But she manipulates him into taking on the job of hiring the nanny. That's the way I saw it.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah, and so she then, as he's going through this whole process, you notice she never talks to Mary Poppins. She puts the entire onus of dealing with Mary Poppins on Mr. Banks.
True.
And she never talks to Mary Poppins in the whole film.
Nope.
That's right.
See, I think Mrs. Banks is a lot smarter than we give her credit for. One to grow
curious.
But Mr. Banks, I just love that intro, because he comes in and he's singing his song and is completely ignoring what's actually happening in the house, because it's just the exact way you want to introduce that character, because that's the way he goes through the whole movie.
I love when he's patting the children's heads in the song, but the children aren't there.
Yes.
But they're supposed to be right in those spots at that instant in time, and they're not. And he he doesn't even catch on that they're not there until after he's done with his whole little tirade about how his life should be and is, and you know, his little perfect mold of a world. But my favorite line is after the song, after he realizes the kids are missing and he goes to make the phone call, and he goes to his wife, who's trying to explain everything to him. She goes, "Kindly do not attempt to cloud the issue with facts." What a great line.
he does a similar thing again later when everyone is bouncing through the house singing. And he has a similar line there. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but you know, when everyone's so happy and singing supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, he has a similar line there. I just love it. I've had that moment where you say, "Do not attempt to cloud the issue with facts." I've had that. I've been there, so I could relate to that.
You know, when Mr. Banks first comes in to sing "The Life I Lead," you think he will be a relatively cheery gentleman. That's what I think, anyway. But then you start seeing his true nature come out, and I don't know. That's what I thought, that he was going to be a kind of a happier guy.
Well, I think that's kind of the deal, right? Is as long as his world fits this certain pattern and order, he's as chipper as can be. But if anybody gets out of that, which is, you know, life, then it messes up his whole mojo, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, he wouldn't have hit his head on the fireplace twice.
There you go.
I thought it was like three times.
Was it?
He gets really fixated on that paper, doesn't he, by the way?
He does, yeah. So I did want to mention, of course, you know, then the children are returned home and everything gets back to normal, and Mrs. Banks totally manipulates him into taking on the task of hiring a nanny. Does anyone know who the constable is, the actor that portrays the constable?
Yeah, he's a guy named Arthur Treacher. Now, this is actually his last or second to last big role ever, because this is the Arthur Treacher who went on to start the fast food chain Arthur Treacher's. That was a fast food fish chain, and it's absolutely amazing. So he lived until I think like the mid 70s, and the restaurant started like about four. He basically used the money he made from this to start the restaurant.
Yep.
And that was it. And this is, you know, that used to be everybody's favorite fish to go eat. I mean, I remember eating there all the time when I was a kid.
Me too.
Andy hit the Texas tea in the Beverly Hillbillies as well.
That is correct.
Right. Oh, so that's his last role in the Beverly Hillbillies then, because that started after this came out. So.
Yep.
One thing I wanted to point out that I think was very telling about Mr. Banks and goes with the main crux of the film to me is that the constable refers to the children as his valuables. I found these valuables, and he's like, what valuables did you possibly find? Right after knowing that his kids are gone. And, you know, it goes to, he doesn't recognize the fact that his children are valuable.
Right. Well, he doesn't recognize their value, period. That's really, that's what's broken in the family, is that he doesn't see the family as a unit. He sees it as something that he has mapped out into his world. And, you know, that's, well, we'll get to that later, because that's actually a very important part.
Yeah, I'm going to have to stick up for Mr. Banks, because I relate to Mr. Banks. He's not that bad.
Why am I not surprised to hear that, Ryan?
I always like the ones in the movie. What can I say? But David Tomlinson is Mr. Banks. Come on.
This is He also says when he's right, when he's dictating his version of the ad, the words he uses are mold the breed.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, dude, you are so in for it. That's what you think. I mean, even when I was a kid, I think I understood that that was like, dude, you're just wrong.
Yep. That's the truth. But yeah, the dueling nanny descriptions I thought is really good when he's going on the how they're going to mold the breed. And then, of course, Jane and Michael come down and offer their, wish list of all the things they want their nanny to be, which is basically like spoil them rotten. Which I thought, I mean, like if you've ever asked a kid, like, what do you want? That's what you're going to get. So, and then, of course, we have the. The paper blows up the chimney of what the kids had written, and the nannies come in. I really love Ellen's face when she tells the master of all these things going outside. But I think another illustration of how Mr. Banks is so insular is, of course, you know, when it becomes 8 o'clock and Admiral Boom sets off the cannon, and all, you know, Mrs. Banks and Ellen and Cook are all, you know, trying to hold on to everything, and he's, you know, he's just swaying from side to side, straightening his tie. You know, he's totally oblivious to all these things these people are doing out around him. You know, it's as long as his world is fine, then everything should be fine. You know?
Yeah. I love when he's swaying back and forth and looking in the mirror. That's also swaying. You're kind of doing that with him as you're watching the film.
Oh yeah.
He's just correcting his world as he goes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's the perfect metaphor for the way he is. And then, of course, we get the wind blowing all the nannies away, and Mary Poppins comes to town, which is a fabulous scene. Julie Andrews, give it up.
Yes, everybody. Yes. Woo!
Academy Award winner Julie Andrews. Yes.
Dame Julie Andrews.
That's right. Disney legend Julie Andrews.
There you go.
Yeah, we could spend the rest of the podcast actually talking about all the things Julie Andrews has.
Okay.
I mean, can I just stop for a moment and say that Julie Andrews is probably one of the most amazingly aged women. You know, she doesn't look exactly like she did here, but I mean, she just looks like maybe 10 years older, not like the, 30, 40 years older that she is from this movie. 46
years old.
Yeah, 46 years old. Yeah. So I mean, it's just interesting. I mean, she aged very well.
She did.
Definitely.
Is this your favorite? Everyone's favorite Julie Andrews film?
No.
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 Which one is that?
I'm a Princess Diaries girl.
Oh, okay.
Sound of Music.
Mine too. Todd.
No, I would stick with this. I mean, I love Sound of Music, but this is just I have childhood reasons for this. That's why.
So yeah, they're close.
I'm going to make a true confession. I've never seen The Sound of Music.
Shame.
Just yeah. Wow.
No.
You are no longer allowed on this podcast.
Yep.
You know, it's not a Disney movie, so
exactly.
That's true.
But yeah. Did you guys know? Mary Poppins was the number one movie at the box office in 1965. Do you know what the number two film was?
Sound of Music.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. See?
Number three?
I do not know number three. Jeff Chaney?
My Fair Lady.
There you go.
My Fair Lady.
There you go.
Wow.
The film that Julie Andrews should have starred in.
Absolutely.
But didn't ended up in Mary Poppins.
Yeah, well, she was up for the role, right? But she took this instead.
No, she was not offered the role, so took this instead.
Oh, okay.
Jack Warner at Warner Brothers made probably the biggest casting mistake of his life.
Whoops!
And picked Audrey Hepburn, who did a fine job in My Fair Lady. Don't get me wrong, but ended up with having to compete with Mary Poppins starring Julie Andrews. Not the best business decision Jack Warner ever made.
No.
but of course, Julie Andrews shows up as Mary Poppins and gets the job in a rather roundabout way, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Oh, I just want to make mention that right before Mary Poppins comes in, one of the maids opens the door just to see if the rest of the possibilities there are in line. And I got to make mention of the little dog, Andrew, who's sitting there looking up at her with the cutest eyes. And if you have been listening to this podcast, you know that I have a huge soft spot for dogs. So I just had to make mention of Andrew.
His little plaid coat.
Yes,
I know. Coat.
He does have quite the coat, indeed.
But the whole interview is very funny because it's not so much as an interview for Mr. Banks, because really she just kind of dumbfounds him and then he hits his head, and I think those two things combined, he loses something, and he just assumes that she's convinced him that he's hired her, and she just goes upstairs and takes care of the kids.
Yeah, and what I love is that she gives him a trial period.
Yeah.
I think we need a trial period. I'll give you 1 week.
Yeah. I love the way that he plays it off. Again, telling you, Mrs. Banks is behind this whole thing. The way he plays it off when she walks in and is like, well, what's going on? And he's like, oh, it's done. It's done. I've taken care of the whole thing. She's upstairs. I put her to work right away. Tell me you guys have not played off something like that, like at work or at home or something like that, where something happens and you just played off like, yeah, I meant to do that. Of course. It's all taken care of.
Oh, yeah.
I do that every day. I think I say I meant to do that at least once.
Same here.
Of course, then we get Mary Poppins introducing herself to the children, and the classic scene where she's pulling endless sorts of things out of the carpet bag, including her measuring tape to measure the kids, which is just a really great moment in the film.
Yeah, great. That's when we see the first mention of practically perfect in every way on the ruler.
Yes, on the ruler. Plus, the kids are funny because it like pretty much pegs the kids too, right? Because like the boy is he's Michael. He's extremely stubborn and suspicious. Yeah. And the girl Jane, right?
Yes,
sorry,
Jane.
I'm drawing a blank. Wow, that's good. Is what does it say? Rather inclined to giggle and doesn't put things away. And I'm thinking, that's every kid in the world right there between those two statements, right?
Yes.
True.
One of my favorite quotes that she makes when she pulls the lamp out, she says, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever," which is actually from a Keats poem.
Interesting. Okay, I didn't know that.
Neat.
And, another bit of a movie trivia for you.
All right.
That quote is made in another movie.
Go for it.
Star Wars.
Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh!
By Mr. Gene Wilder.
Yes, you're right. You're right.
Nice. Okay.
Well done.
Like, guess there, Cheryl.
I like how the kids play into the bag, too, right? Because they're doing things like crawl under the table. And it's like you know how they do that by now if you're, like, a movie person, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry to anyone who doesn't, because I'm not going to ruin it, though. But they're crawling under the table, and they're playing into the whole thing, and it's awesome. You know, they really thought out the scene of it.
Oh, yeah. The way it's cut and the way that you see that is just perfect. I mean, it's a great way to play that off. But we mentioned the kids, Karen Dotrice and Matthew Garber. They had actually appeared in an earlier Disney film, The Three Lives of Thomasina. And they would appear again in The Gnome-mobile, which I have not seen, but is another Disney film I really want to see because I hear it's epically bad. But I want to see it. I don't know if it's epically bad. I've just heard that it is, and I want to see it because I have a hard time believing it, but that's just me. Of course, so the Mary Poppins scene in the nursery leads to another great moment in the film, which is the spoonful of sugar sequence where everything's cleaning up in the nursery. It's a great use of effects here from Ob Iwerks, who long history with the Disney company. He won an Oscar for the effects in this film, along with the other folks who worked on it, but most of the credit was given to him. The effects in this sequence include a few different things, but running the film backwards in order to see the pieces popping back into the drawers, or you know, the beds being making themselves up, that sort of a thing. It's something that had been done before, but I don't think it had been done quite this well, of marrying the actors in the scene acting on a separate mat versus what's happening in front of them. Very, very well done. And there's other, you know, great effects in this sequence as well.
I love the line, the quote that opens the scene, because this is kind of sort of how I kind of approach pretty much everything I do. Okay, and that is, in every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun and snap, the job's a game. That is, I found that, you know, when you're not going to enjoy something, or you can just do anything, just have fun at it. I mean, you shouldn't spend time. It goes back to what Jeff was saying earlier about, you know, you work to live, you don't live to work, because you want to focus on the right things, not the wrong things.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, yeah. That statement is so ridiculously true. I mean, even when you have to do tasks such as dusting. Take me, for example. I blast music and wear my tiara. And it helps. Just saying.
Understandable.
Yeah.
I've been known to blast music and wear my tiara, too, while cleaning up. It's okay.
I say Cinderella Bowl.
There you go.
Another interesting part of this whole sequence is the use of animatronic birds.
Yes.
And I did some research, and actually this was filmed during the time that the Enchanted Tiki Room was being created.
Oh.
So,
do you think there were model birds for that?
I think that, I mean, at least there had to have been a connection there. The Sherman Brothers wrote the Tiki Room song, right?
Yes.
So, there, you know, that had to have been some kind of connection there.
Wait, can I say the line? That's very beta mouse of you, Jeff.
Oh.
Nice.
Thank you.
Nicely done.
I wanted to add too that the beauty of this song is that most people don't realize this, but Julie Andrews is doing both parts. Now, you might not realize that there's two parts to this song, okay? But because there's the singing piece that everybody focuses on, but there's also the birds whistling, and she actually recorded that separately, and then both are played against each other. So she's actually the whistling bird as well as singing the song as Mary Poppins.
Oh, wow, that is awesome.
Yeah, and that's actually common. There's most of the lead actors are actually doing a couple different things in the movie. Like David Tomlinson actually is the voice of the umbrella at the end when the umbrella talks to Mary Poppins. Dick Van Dyke plays the older Mr. Dawes at the bank.
Yep.
And so a lot of the lead actors played a couple of different elements of the film, and you mentioned Julie Andrews there. So interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then after that sequence, we get the first outing with the children. Is it me, or does this film take place in like a day and a half?
I was wondering that too, because she gives them a week, but she's gone in like 3 days.
Yeah, just curious. But they do they meet Bert, who as we mentioned earlier is humming Chim Chim Cheree again, but this time applying it to the chalk drawings. Where you see him drawing the various drawings that eventually they will jump into.
One of the things, I don't know if anyone ever could find this. I did some searching and couldn't, but when it shows him drawing, it distinctly cuts away, and there's just a hand drawing. And I'm hoping I know who this is. But please, Ryan, tell me.
I know. It's Peter Ellenshaw.
Ah.
It is it's his hand doing the drawings because he did the drawings in the chalk.
See, now that makes plenty of sense. I was wondering that when you're talking about that earlier, because I know that was a question Jeff had mentioned earlier in the day. So,
yep, I did. I saw that. It's actually on not the they put out a 40th or 45th edition DVD of some kind recently. But if you have the old gold collection DVD, there's a making of vignette on that, that little tidbit came from there. That's about the only useful tidbit from that piece, but you know, I was able to answer Jeff's question because I have the oldest version of this on DVD.
See, so Dad, I feel happy. That's what happens when you buy the new versions. Apparently you miss stuff.
There you go. Although I will have to say that I want this movie on Blu-ray in the worst way. But that's just me.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we have the fun scene where they jump into the chalk painting. And it's the grand jolly holiday sequence, which I think is like one of the best pieces of filmmaking I've ever seen. Just the entire sequence from beginning to end. The combination of the animation, the live action, the dancing, the singing, everything kind of comes together. I mean, the film as a whole is really Walt's masterpiece. It's everything he learned how to do between live action and song and animation and even animatronics, like we just mentioned. But this sequence itself, I think, is kind of unrivaled in film.
This is also when you encounter Bert and Mary in the parks, for example. This is the outfits that they're always in, right? That's the scene where they come from. This, you never see them in anything but those two outfits.
Yeah, you're right. I you had mentioned that to me earlier, and I thought about that. I know I've seen her in the regular nanny outfit, but
And I thought back, no, I haven't.
Yeah, Actually, you're wrong.
Oh, am I?
She's in the parade. And then one of the new, in the back of, she's on the back of the floats in one of the new parades. Is Bert and Mary on Chimney.
Oh. Yeah, I actually have a photo of that. Yeah.
Oh, well.
See? So, you know, we're wrong. All
right. Todd,
so,
you can't always be right.
there's all kinds of great stuff in here. Of course, they follow the zoo animals, so we see the baritone hog singing and several different voices singing from the zoo animals.
Right, and they're famous voices too. The baritone hog is Thurl Ravenscroft, who everybody knows from the Haunted Mansion and stuff like that,
or from Tony the Tiger.
Very good. Yes. And also, by the way, just for Brianna, he voices Andrew the dog. Just saying.
Oh.
there's Marnie Nixon, who a lot of people don't realize this is the voice of the singing voice for Anna in The King and I. She's also Sister Sophia in The Sound of Music.
And she was Natalie Wood's singing voice in West Side Story. Too.
Was she? Okay. Was. And she's also, more recently, the grandmother in Mulan.
Oh,
I didn't know that. Interesting.
So, did anyone else hear, I mean, basically Bert and Mary are on a date in this whole thing, right? Is it just me? I
think it goes to what he said before, right? It's he said this is all, in the very beginning, Bert says this has all happened before, right? And that's very Cylon, but that's a different thing. But I agree. They are obviously, there's something going on there. You know, it goes back to what Ryan was saying as well, is in the beginning, is that Travers didn't want this in the movie, but apparently everybody else did, and it plays so well. It just it makes the scene. If it wasn't there, this would not be as much fun.
Well, she explicitly had them put in. There's that whole little bit in the song where they're singing back and forth to each other, and I can't remember the exact lines, but you know, Bert is singing about how wonderful Mary Poppins is, but then you see Mary Poppins almost rebuff his advances a little bit with the song, where she says, you know, you'd never think of pressing your advantage, you know, underneath your blood is blue, all these sorts of, there's all these sorts of lines that kind of make it clear that, like, there will not be any romantic future in this relationship. And that was specifically added to appease P.L. Travers.
Oh, interesting.
So unfortunate.
Yeah.
They were in love.
I think it works better the way it is, you know, because you get to, it's kind of left there for you. If you want it, it's there. If you don't, it's, you know, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's just my opinion. But then, of course, we have the wonderful sequence with the penguins, where we have the Dick Van Dyke dancing with the penguins.
That's a great scene.
I love this scene. This is my favorite scene.
Why is it your favorite scene, hon?
I don't know. I'm a big fan of Dick Van Dyke. I'm a big, really big fan. I've followed his little series that he had with his sons. I continue to follow him whenever he's on, like, on a talk show. I'll stop and I'll watch, even if it's like Ellen or something like that. I love that he's doing this New Harmony thing. It's so really. Wait,
and let's not forget how many times you've made me watch Night at the Museum because he's in it.
Yes. Oh. Yeah. I really was disappointed he wasn't in the sequel.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to chime in on that one.
I'm with you on that one, actually, Cheryl.
But I really am a big fan of his, and I don't know. I think this comes from that. I think it comes from that. So
that scene always reminds me of Crystal Palace. And I know, I mean, Crystal Palace is kind of Edwardian, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that makes sense, but I just always see that scene and think, man, they should really have Mary Poppins in Crystal Palace instead of Winnie the Pooh.
Is it because they kind of have the vines and the trees inside the Crystal Palace? You get that feeling?
Yeah, and the chairs are that ornate, you know, wrought iron looking. And yeah, I mean, you know.
Well, she's okay. In the Grand Floridian, though.
It's a great sequence, and of course then that's followed up by the merry-go-round sequence with the horses jumping off the carousel, which, I mean, when I was a kid, I every time I rode a carousel, I'm like, it's gonna happen this time. Come on, it's gonna happen this time. We're gonna jump off and we're gonna go on a horse race. It's gonna happen. It never did, and I blame this movie for ruining my childhood that way.
Aww. So I'm a little OCD, right? And what bothers me the most about the whole thing with the merry-go-rounds is that the posts are constantly ripping up the ground.
Yes, they are.
I'm like, can you just stop destroying everything?
Only you, Todd, would take that away from this piece of film.
Okay, so the fourth time watching it this week, I had an epiphany, and it's probably a stupid one, but, you know, you talked about, you thought that Mrs. Banks is the, you know, mastermind.
Absolutely.
I actually found, after watching it so many times, I think Bert is the most important character in the whole movie. And I think he's really the link between the children / childhood and the adults / adulthood. In this scene, Mary compares Bert to the children. You know, oh, Bert, you're as bad as the children. Mm-hmm. The children really aren't bad. And that's one of the things I think that's interesting. In the movie, we don't really ever see the kids being bad, right?
Right.
I mean, and I don't think the children are bad. I think the children are children, which, you know. So I think that Bert is very important in that, you know, not only does he help the children – or the adults realize that the children are important and special, you know, which comes later, but he also helps the children understand some of what's happening with the adults. So,
yeah, I think you're right, Jeff. And also, it's like almost as if we see the film through his eyes. Because, you know, as Ryan was saying before, he kind of broke the fourth wall with addressing the audience. So it's almost as if we're seeing what else happens also through his eyes. Like, it's his point of view throughout the film.
I thought perhaps he had been a prior child that maybe Mary helped out before, you know, because there is that whole thing about him saying this has happened before, you know, and
yeah,
I've never read the book, so I don't know if it's tied in or not, but I always like to, you know, look deeper into something like that.
Yeah.
That would be interesting.
That's an interesting thought. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's good thought, though. Yeah, he's definitely, I think, you know, in a few different places, it's Bert, things that Bert says are kind of catalysts for change in the characters. It's especially at the end, and we'll get to it, but where he's talking to the children about their father, he definitely is the reason why they change their view of him, and then he does the same thing with Mr. Banks just a few moments later.
Yeah.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves like we always do. So, of course, Mary wins the horse race and has the wonderful supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Right after the freaky pose, though, right? I mean, she does this, I don't even know how a human stands like that for even, like, a second to pose for a picture. She's leaning back, and she's on her toes, and she puts her hands on her knees, and she's, like, all curved in this circle. If you look, I've looked at that, like, several times at this point, and I cannot figure out how a person actually manages to stand like that. But
she's Dame Julie Andrews, Todd. Yeah,
she can do anything. Right. She's legendary.
She's pretty amazing. That's true. But they're all interviewing her, right? And they ask her if she has anything to say. And she starts to say, well, I have nothing to say. But instead she goes, oh, actually, I have one thing to say. And, you know, and she goes, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. And they're all like, what? And she goes, it's the biggest word you've ever heard, blah, blah, blah. And she gets into the whole song. And it's really like a bar song. And that's like the beauty of it. And that's why it's so catchy. It's like you could picture going to like Raglan Road at Pleasure Island. And you could picture the people getting up there and doing their table dancing. And table dancing to supercalifragilisticexpialidocious without question.
We're doing that next time I'm down.
Actually, we'll make it way with it more Yeehaw Bob, I think. I think it would work more Yeehaw Bob. That would be fun.
Well, I say we do both. Sure. I say both.
My favorite line in that song is the, you know, I once said it to a girl, and now that girl's my wife.
Yeah.
I love it.
So we finish all of this and leave the chalk painting and come back to – they get rained on and come back to the nursery and have to take the medicine, which is a fun little bit, of course. where they get to taste the different colored medicines, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny. I mean, I don't remember what the flavor – one of the kids is strawberry, and I forget what the other one is. But what's funny is she goes, rum punch, after she takes her spoonful. And it's just like it's a throw-off, but it's like a little out of place. But, you know, she's like a little – she's a little mischievous herself, and that's why, you know, she gets the rum punch.
Absolutely. She sings the fun song of Stay Awake, or not fun, I should say, but the very good song.
And that was actually Julie Andrews' favorite song. And originally it was going to get cut, and she demanded that it be put in the movie.
Yeah, it was also one of those songs where they weren't originally going to have it in the movie, like you were saying. And they put it in because they liked the melody of another song. So they wrote this to use the melody that they liked, because they didn't like the other song they wrote for that melody. And they were really looking for something, because this was originally the words that are "Stay Awake" were coming from one of a few songs that were originally designed to introduce Mary to the kids, as opposed to the nursery scene. Okay, but because they cut all that and used the nursery scene as the introduction moment, they kind of reworked things, and they took this melody from over here and took the words, and they came up with this song.
Well, it's a fantastic song. I mean, just perfect. Fits the mood perfectly. Fits Mary perfectly. It's just wonderfully placed in the film, which of course leads to one of my favorite sequences. Which I know it's not one of the songs or anything like that. But the next morning, when Mr. Banks comes in and he's sitting down, and you can tell he must have had a bad day at the office the day before or something, and he just wants to sit down and have his tea and eat his eggs, and everyone is marching through the house singing "Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious."
Okay, yeah, no, I like the morning in the Banks house as well, because they're going around and everybody's singing and everybody's still dancing and they're still doing their supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, and apparently they made scrambled eggs, and he doesn't know how to serve food on his own plate because he scrapes it and it's like across the plate, half on the table, some of it falls on the floor, and he just ignores it. He's eating it, and then 8 o'clock comes along, and they have a moment, and again, clueless Mr. Banks, all he gets out of the Admiral Boom Boom is that the piano's out of tune.
Right.
I mean, it's just when something's wrong with his world, he notices it, and everything else he's still oblivious to at this point in the movie, other than that people are bothering him because they're dancing around the house singing their songs because they had fun and he didn't understand fun.
That's the line that I was trying to think of earlier, is when he hits the piano and then it slides back into place, and he tells Mrs. Banks, you know, this piano is out of tune. Get somebody here to fix it, and she says, "But George, you don't play." And he says, "That, madam, is entirely beside the point."
It carries, though, because later when Mary's taking the kids out, right, she's going out, and she says, and she checks off her list, and one of the things is go to the piano tuner. Doesn't a piano tuner come to you? Right? You don't go to the piano tuner. They have to come tune your piano. I didn't understand why it was on her list and she's going out.
I think just to torture her, because Mr. Banks is not happy with her at that point. But you mentioned that, so she goes out to go to the piano tuner. And then, of course, our friend Andrew the dog shows up and convinces her that she needs to go somewhere else. And we see Uncle Albert with the "I Love to Laugh" song, where everybody's floating and the tea party's taking place on the ceiling. I'm just going to interject on this one. I love the sequence. It's very funny. It does nothing to serve the story in my mind.
No, I think it's because it was a scene from the book originally. I don't think it was Uncle Albert. I think it was a different relative or character in the book. But I think that it was just a scene that someone liked, or maybe Travers insisted was in because to her it was important. I don't really know. It is a lot of fun. I mean, it's, you know, because it's bad joke after bad joke after bad joke. And let me tell you, that's all I am. Bad joke after bad joke.
No, Uncle Albert is actually my favorite character in the entire film. But, yeah, Ryan, you're right. I mean, the scene doesn't really serve much of a purpose
actually,
to the film. But it's an enjoyable one.
It's also a connection, folks. Uncle Albert was also Mad Hatter.
Yes, he was.
So maybe it's a nod. Because they're having a tea party, right? Up on the ceiling.
Very true.
A tea party, and he's a little loony. Yeah, that's true. I think the point here is this might be a setup for the end, though, right? Because we know how the senior Mr. Dawes dies, right?
Yes.
He dies from laughing to death. And I think that's why Mary and Bert are so concerned, because there's an indication that if you laugh too much, you will laugh yourself to death. And they don't want that to happen to Uncle Albert for whatever reason. I think that's what's actually going on in this scene, though it's not made very clear.
Right. No, I think it's definitely a setup for that. It didn't have to be there, right? You could have gone another way with it and sure. with Mr. Dawes and lost this. But I mean, it's absolutely fun and enjoyable to watch. All right, so we get Mary Poppins pulling the role reversal on Mr. Banks, and where he's trying to scold her, but he ends up basically agreeing to take the kids to the bank, which it's a great kind of a reprise of the first scene there, where he's quote unquote interviewing her.
That's right. She plays him again, you know, and all that, you know, and she does the, you know, first of all, I'd like to make one thing quite clear. I never explain anything.
Yeah.
You know, that whole thing. And then she marches upstairs and that's it. And then she's getting the kids ready in the morning and they go with their father to the bank.
Yep. And then we have her singing to the kids Walt's favorite song, which is Feed the Birds. And if you've ever read anything that the Sherman brothers have ever talked about or written or spoken about, you'll know that they used to, on Friday afternoons, Walt would call them down to his office and he would just say, play it. And they would play this song. And it's, I have to admit, you know, having... As a kid, I didn't get it, right? This was my least favorite sequence in the entire film. I didn't understand it. I didn't know why the Bird Woman was there. I didn't understand the whole thing. And as I've gotten older, this song is really close to my heart too, knowing that it was Walt's favorite song. But just understanding what it means about, you know, taking the time to see, you know, the little people in your life and the folks who are, you know, perhaps not, you know, not the most noticeable or not the most, you know, the folks that you see every day, but the folks who kind of slip between the cracks. It's a touching song. I'll admit, I said before in a previous show, I don't cry at movies, but I do cry at this song.
Yeah, I do too. This song has me bawling every time I watch that particular scene in the movie. I don't know why. It just does. I mean, it's not so much the lyrics. It's just the mood of the song, the scenery of the song. It just really takes you in and tugs your heartstrings majorly.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yep. And then, you know, kind of the last bit of this of the film is an emotional roller coaster, right? So we go from the Fidelity Fiduciary Bank sequence where you know, Dick Van Dyke is doing his great improv or comedic acting rather as the elder Mr. Dawes.
Yeah, and interestingly, there's a part in the scene where Mr. Dawes is having a hard time getting down that step, and I did some research and found out that that was added to the movie after Walt saw Dick Van Dyke doing that skit dressed up as Mr. Dawes and for some of the other crew just joking around, and they actually changed the set and built a step into the set so that he could do that in that part of the movie.
Wow. Well, it's a great little bit. Great fun little bit. But you go from that and the scary part of at the end where Michael loses the tuppence and, you know, is trying to take it back and there's the run on the bank and they're running away. Then we go to what we were talking about earlier with Bert catching them and realize and, you know, and kind of telling them, like, you know, who looks out for your father? And I thought that's a really great piece. You know, again, Jeff, as fathers, I can relate to that. You know, you're trying to work and provide for your family, and sometimes, like, you lose track of these things, you know. It's very touching. And then, but we go from that, you go to the frantic craziness of Chim Chim Cheree up on the rooftops, which,
that's my favorite scene.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
The great movie ride scene.
There you go.
Yeah.
But it's such a great counterpoint to go from that to Chim Chim Cheree and followed by Step in Time, you know, those great musical numbers that are Step in Time is actually based on a English song, Knees Up Mother Brown, which is a great, like, pub song in England. And it was suggested by Peter Ellenshaw that they should do a takeoff on that because these chimney sweeps who are gathered together, they're going to sing something like that. They're going to do a dance like that, you know, those sorts of things. So, but you go from the lows to the highs and then back down to the lows as the, you know, you see, it's almost a sense of foreboding when you see the chimney sweep kind of marching through Mr. Banks, his house, and you see Mr. Banks there. You're really happy and it's a fun scene, but you know, like, oh gosh, this is going to be bad, you know?
If I have a favorite musical number in the whole thing, it's the whole Step in Time thing. It's just, I actually like it better than the stuff that goes on Jolly Holiday. Not that I don't dislike the Jolly Holiday scene. It's just, it's fun and it's pure fun for the sake of fun, which is much different than what's going on in the Jolly Holiday scene. Like Jeff said, Jolly Holiday's a date. You know, it's an afternoon stroll kind of thing. But this is just, everybody's kind of sort of, they're winding down. They've had a bad afternoon. Mary Poppins has come from whatever happens on Tuesdays. Bert's doing his third jack of all trades side job. And he's, you know, so he's there and he's been sucked in to come clean the chimney. Instead, the kids get sucked up the chimney. I love the intro to the whole thing. The intro is just fantastic because, you know, the whole birds and stars and chimney sweeps thing. It's just, he holds them all in. I love that.
And it's back to the whole life is what you make it thing. You know, he has the best job ever because he's a chimney sweep. Mm-hmm. He has the best job ever because he has the mentality of whatever job he's doing is the best job ever.
Absolutely.
Yep. But you precisely.
You go from those highs to him getting the phone call from the bank and that foreboding, haunting music playing as he walks down the street to the bank. And, you know, they punch his hat through and turn his umbrella inside out. And you just think at that point that, you know, it's all over at that point until he starts. Something clicks in his head while he's standing there in that bank of things that Bert said, of what the kids have said, of what Mary Poppins has done. And he starts, you know, just sort of going off on all these different tangents, and he finally gets it, you know, but he almost can't express it. And that's where the supercalifragilisticexpialidocious right. comes back.
I think it starts from the moment the kids give him the tuppence, right? Because that's the tuppence are the children. Okay, is how I kind of look at the whole thing. Is they represent what the going and the coming and the, you know, so the kids have been away from him. They've been separated from him effectively in his life because he's intentionally done that. And giving the tuppence, the kids giving the tuppence back to him is the kids coming back into his life. And that's when he has this life changing moment. That's the whole reason for the walk. And there's like five or six scenes in that walk, and it's very long, well drawn out. And the bird lady is missing, which is, again, you know, why the feed the birds thing gets me so much is because she's gone, and she's gone for a reason, because, you know, there's more to it. It's you have to, he notices she's gone, right? Because he noticed her before. He's starting to click and find the world again and find his kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we finished the whole film off with "Let's Go Fly a Kite."
That's my favorite song.
Woohoo!
I love it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic song that just kind of sums up the entire, you know, the idea of the film, that, you know, any, you know, things could get bad, but you know what? We can all go fly a kite and be happy together. And that's Mary Poppins for you.
Yeah. Can I make a quick comment about the kite? The repair symbol on it resembles the Jewish word "hi," which you'll see a lot of Jewish people wear on their chest. And this is important because that's actually "hi" is life. That's what it means. Okay, and this is about a movie about life and changing life, and it's just very. And I think it's almost intentional that it looks like that. Either that, or I'm reading way too much into it. One or the other.
Thank you, Uncle Sluice.
It is always possible.
And I also love the umbrella talking to her, and that he understands how much she really cares about the children, and they actually love their dad more than her. And she says it, and that's how it should be.
Yeah. It's just, honestly, just from beginning to end, almost a perfect film, I think. It's hard to sit here and go, well, that piece doesn't work. I think the only thing we said through the entire film that, you know, it's like, the, you know, the I Love to Laugh piece doesn't exactly serve the story, but it's so fun anyway that, you know, you don't really care. So anything else anybody wanted to mention before we wrap up?
another part I wanted to mention was the Sherman Brothers, because we actually met one of the Sherman Brothers on the member cruise. One of my friends is a really big fan, and so I actually ended up taking a picture with her and the guy who was on the ship with us. And
great.
And he spoke. He had a really, his session on the cruise was really great. I mean, it was so fun. It was such an honor. Like, after Lou Margiello came out afterwards, I think a year later, I think Lou Margiello came out with his interview. And it was just like total, again, remembrance.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, so let's wrap this up then.
Couple things I just want to mention. Interesting little tidbits of behind the scenes movie stuff. Originally, they were looking at Betty Davis to be Mary Poppins. The character in the books apparently is a little more stern and gruff.
A lot more.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and originally Julie Andrews didn't want to do the film because she thought she was going to be picked for My Fair Lady. When she didn't get that, she went to the Mary Poppins, and obviously a great choice. Dick Van Dyke, the first choice for Walt Disney there was Danny Kaye, which my second one. I have two like old movie. I love Dick Van Dyke, and I love Danny Kaye, so. Part of me goes, wow, I wonder what that would have been like. I mean, I'm glad they went with Dick Van Dyke. But funnily enough, Dick Van Dyke did not have to audition for the part of Bert. However, he did have to audition for the part of Mr. Dawes.
That's pretty fun.
I just wanted to add that some of the songs that got shelved actually get used later on in Disney, in certain Disney things. One of them, there's a song called The Right Side that sat until 1983. Until it was used as Winnie the Pooh's personal theme song in Welcome to Pooh Corner. Okay. Katie Nana was going to have a song that was later reworked for The Happiest Millionaire. Actually, there's two more. One was dropped and later became Trust in Me for Jungle Book. And then The Beautiful Brinny was literally just shelved completely as was and used in Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Yeah, I think there was when we get to Bedknobs and Broomsticks, I think there's actually a lot of the score and music that was reused for that film that was cut from this one in an attempt to make it similar. And I actually really like Bedknobs and Broomsticks, so we'll talk about that another time. It is no Mary Poppins, so how are we going to say that Mary Poppins measures up? Let's say Todd Perlmutter.
Oh, I'm going 4.5 because practically perfect in every way.
I want to know where that half is missing. Brianna Alessio.
You know what? It was the first time I've seen this, so I don't know. I mean, I'm going to go with like 4.75 because I can't give it a perfect 5 because it was the first time, and, I have to pay attention to more aspects of the film. But it's a gorgeous film, and it's so beautiful, and I love this so much. So I don't know, 4.75.
Jeff has disowned you.
All right, so Jeff and I will be starting our own show next week.
That's awesome.
How to properly rate movies. Jeff?
So, it's a 5. I don't know. I mean, there's very few ways that this could have been a better movie. I think I love the matte paintings, but I think that the shooting the entire thing on a soundstage, I think they got dinged on cinematography. And My Fair Lady is just a better shot movie, which is what won the Academy Award that year. But still, this is a Disney movie. Like, this is what movie all Disney movies should be held up to, and then we rate from there.
I absolutely agree. This is the absolute best film Walt Disney was ever involved in. So it is a 5. Just
but it's
for
not
that,
your favorite Leo. Though, right, Ryan?
It's not his favorite.
It's not your favorite.
It is not my favorite Disney film. No, okay. It is my favorite Disney film that Walt Disney was ever involved in. I am not revealing my favorite Disney film until we do that show.
Okay.
And I haven't even told these guys what that is, so everyone will live in suspense.
Yes.
All right. So that's going to do it for our show this week. We hope you enjoyed our look at Mary Poppins. Until next week, stay in touch with us on Twitter. Visit us at DisneyFilmProject.com. You can listen to the show there. You can download it, subscribe on iTunes, all that stuff from DisneyFilmProject.com. You can visit, read my blog post at DisneyDrivenLife.com and see Todd's chief technical wizardry there as well. You can read Todd and I blogging on TouringPlans.com. You can see Bree at Adventures of Bree at adventuresofbree.blogspot.com. She has quite the adventures. Please go and read that. Make sure you listen to Jeff on Beta Mouse, which I think we are keeping him from recording this evening, but you know, those guys can wait.
C'est la vie.
Just kidding, guys. I'm just kidding. We're sorry. Read his blogs, read his blogs rather, wedwayradio.com. And find him on Twitter and help him have a laugh, because he very rarely is allowed to get on there anymore because he's a busy, busy man. If you like this show, tell your friends, tell everyone else about the show, and please leave us a review on iTunes. Spread the word, and we will see you next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Later.